Welcome to The Lightest Tread, the official podcast of Soul, where we speak to extraordinary and ordinary people who do ordinary and extraordinary things that are good for their bodies, good for the planets, and typify the soul of adventure. I'm your host, Paul Morn Brown, and my guest today is Amathan Sivaraja. As a boy, Amathan survived civil war in Sri Lanka before moving to Canada with his family. His life has followed many varied paths, including academia, advocacy, and activism, but the paths he has most passion for are those he can follow across continents one step at a time. Amathan has thru-hiked many of the world's most famous long-distance trails and offers a nuanced and considered perspective on what it is to thru-hike in the socio-political context of the modern world. Listeners can get 15% off yoursoul.com by entering the code JUNEBUG15 at checkout. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please do take a moment to rate it and subscribe. Thanks a lot. Enjoy. Listen up, folks. It's time for The Lightest Tread. Hey, we're rolling with Amathan Sivaraja. I say that right, hey?
Yep. I actually recently been reading an article about, I don't know if you've, this is just a little preamble, like a while back, Hasan Minhaj went off on Ellen for mispronouncing his name. And then recently another comedian went off on like local audience for anglicizing his name, his South Asian name. And he's like, well, this is what I've been called all my life. So I always tell people I have no idea what my name actually sounds like in English. My mom calls me one thing. My family calls me something else. Almost always someone puts an R in there somewhere. There's no R. So I don't know.
Okay.
That's right.
Cool. What does your mother call you?
She calls me Amitten. Okay. Which is not that easy if you don't have that the inflection in your tongue growing up speaking a language that specifies the T sounds.
So I grew up in South Africa, as you may or may not remember, but I grew up watching Sri Lankan cricketers, one of whom was Muthai Muralitharan was the anglicized way of saying it, but yeah, always a mouthful for the commentators. Yeah, exactly. Anyway, welcome. Thanks for joining me. You're based on the island now, on Vancouver Island, is that right?
Yeah. I'm in Vancouver Island, pretty close to or at the edge of Nanaimo at the moment.
Oh, nice.
All over the BC. It's been a journey the last couple of years.
Yeah. During COVID, you were sort of isolated. I can't remember exactly where, but next to a beautiful lake. I remember feeling quite jealous of you out in the wilderness while we were city bound.
Yeah, deep in the bowels of the Kootenai Lake, surrounded by glaciers and having grizzly bears for neighbors. It's pretty nice. Not cell service though, but it's pretty cool.
Yeah. So maybe we should start by just sort of talking about your credentials as a through hiker. Not that they matter necessarily, but just to give listeners some perspective on where you've been and what you've done.
Yeah, sure. I guess I walked a few miles. I've started with the Appalachian Trail, I suppose, like of my first real sort of through hike. Since then, I've completed the Te Aroha in New Zealand, on both islands, of course. The Arizona Trail, the Great Divide Trail from Waterton National Park all the way to Mount Robson, which is incredible. About 1,200 miles on the Continental Divide Trail. And recently I just finished thru-hiking the Pacific Crest Trail. So about 7,000 or 8,000 miles in there somewhere.
So the Great Divide Trail is the sort of Canadian section of the Continental Divide Trail? Do I understand that correctly?
Well, Great Divide Trail is its own entity. Like the Great Divide Trail Association is its own entity, and it is like exclusively in Canada. But the CDT, the Connell Divide Trail, is pretty unique in the sense that it is the only long distance trail in the U.S. that has what you would call a dual terminus. So you can either start in Canada or in the U.S. In fact, most what you would call the old school OG southbounders who would say that the proper, the purest whatever, or at least what I think the most weather friendly approach to have a continuous through hike on the CDT would be to start in Canada and go southbound in July, so that you hit the it's tough right off the bat. That's a cricket term, by the way. I don't know if you ever noticed that right off the bat. People say it all the time, but I don't know if they ever realize that that's a cricket term. But anyway, yeah, you start at the Canadian border at Waterton National Park, and then you do this cool little video. It's such a strange thing. You do a video interview with the border agent remotely, and this is before COVID times in some ways. You do a video interview, and then they give you a 2-hour window to cross into the US. There's nobody there. You just walk from Canada to the US, pretty much from Alberta to Montana, just go for a walk. And next thing you know, you're on the other, you're the other side of Glacier. It's pretty cool.
Amazing. And so how do you do the video interview? I mean, I'm fascinated by this. Just like on a phone, or you pull
Just
into it?
on a cell, yeah, on a cell phone. There is a there's a person at the crossing as well on the road, but it's just on the other side of Waterton National Park, and it's a long drive. And if you're through hiking, it's almost the logistics of getting into Terminus is hard enough on any given trail, except perhaps the Appalachian Trail. This one, you know, a stranger can't just pick you up and drive you through the border. It's just not gonna happen. So, and then you can't exactly walk, get dropped off at the border and walk there either. But in the old days, like people would go to Chief, which is on the Glacier side of things and the US side of things. When they finish there or start there, they would dip around, come into Waterton. What I did was I basically set up a phone interview. There's an app called Mobile Roam, and you just do a video interview and enter your credentials, and they're like, right, you have from 9 a.m. to 11:30 p.m. to make your this 5 mile hike to the Treaty Agreement Monument, the Southern or Northern Monument, whichever you will, and then you walk over. So if you went south, you'd go on the CDT. If you went north, you'll be on the Great Divide Trail, right at
Awesome.
the border of Waterton Lake.
Sure. And so, I mean, that's the walking north to south, as you said, is relatively unique in that on the other major trails, the PCT and the Appalachian Trail, most people will walk south to north.
Most people walk south to north. It's just been traditionally that's been the way on, especially on the Appalachian Trail. It used to make a lot of sense. A lot of it, I feel, is inertia in some ways, because that's how it was done and that's how you do it. And sometimes the mile markers are set up that way, you know, like the infrastructures have set up that way in some ways. And of course, you can never underestimate the power of just sheer inertia, you know. And the weather window, on the other hand, for each of those three trails, and specifically, it's pretty unique. So if you were to start a southbound hike, your time span is a lot longer on the AT. You would, of course, start at a very difficult section. You'd have to go up Mount Katahdin, which is a pretty difficult mountain to climb, and then come down, and then go through Maine, which is arguably throws everything the AT has on you in one state. And then you'd have to take the time off when you start getting closer and closer to fall, because you can't come down Katahdin until whenever it opens, like June or something. So you can't really start that southbound hike until June. Same for CDT. Snowpack determines when you can start a southbound hike. You're just simply not going to get through those immense and wild places in Glacier National Park in the middle of a snowstorm, or if the snowpack is really heavy. So July, June is like you could. June's probably too early, but July is like a good time to start. Early July is a good time to start. That's when I started, and then you southbound. But then you hit that, like you get the difficult bit out of the way on the CDT, and then you start hitting just the greatest weather. Like you get to Colorado at the right time. You get New Mexico when it's colder. The water's better. Bugs are a little bit less. Yes, you are into grizzly bear season, but there's really no avoiding bear season on the CDT. PCT, on the other hand, if you start at southbound hike, yeah, again, very tricky, especially now with the wildfires and the impact of like human impact on trails, both in terms of like the trail itself, but also the environment, makes it harder and harder. I think, to do a continuous uninterrupted trail. I don't know for how much longer that's feasible to have a continuous uninterrupted trail starting north. Flip-flop, meaning start from one end, flip around, have a little bit more flex in your travel plans is probably more sustainable going forward, for all sorts of reasons, particularly for the impact that we have on these trails. But yeah, the weather determines how you should go, and it's probably a good advice not to just follow what everybody else is doing and do what's best for you on that trail.
Yeah, the issue of flip-flopping and how to approach managing weather and natural, well, disasters, I guess, in terms of wildfires. It's a conversation I had with Morgan Brosnahan, Blaze Physio, who you actually put us in touch with originally. That was great. Yeah, crazy to think that we are at a stage where there are communities of people who have specific dreams and hopes that just may not be feasible to realize anymore moving forward, due to our impacts on the planet as a species. I actually wanted to speak to, I mean, you were talking about being surrounded by glaciers and being in the wilderness. And I wanted to pull up something that you had in your very first email to us at Seoul. There was a paragraph that you wrote in that mail, which hit a particular chord with me. And I wanted to read that quickly.
Sure.
It went like this. Simply put, people like me cannot readily imagine what is possible in outdoor recreation. Being an immigrant and coming from a South Asian background where education and career ambitions are given high premiums, I am quite attuned to the stigma of choosing mountains. I continue to grapple with the perspective that out there in the wild, I am throwing my life away. It is a story familiar to so many young people of color, regardless of aptitudes. And that point really struck home to me, partly because of my personal experience having moved to Canada in order to pursue, well, snowboarding really was the number one thing that brought me out here. So the mountains, a life that I could live surrounded by the mountains, and it made me reflect on the fact that Western white people have always kind of glamorized exploration and adventure to some extent. And I guess the socio-political sort of sphere in which we exist has allowed us to continue to do so, because if you live in a place of relative comfort and privilege, you have the ability of, recreation can take up more space in your mental sphere, I guess. And, going on adventures may not be to every sort of parent's explicit approval, but there's sort of cultural precedent for adventure and time spent in the wild for its own sake. And when you spoke to that, the sort of stigma of a life spent in the mountains rather than pursuing a career or whatever else it might be, that really struck home to me. And I guess that's just a way of sort of foreshadowing the conversation that I'd like to sort of focus on, with which is the role. I don't know if you consider it your mission or if it's a good question, but you are very vocal in terms of spreading awareness around being a person of color in the outdoors, and the difficulties that you encounter. I don't know, maybe you could start off by telling me, How did the journey sort of evolve for you?
Yeah, I wrote that email a long time ago when I was, yeah, I mean, I accidentally like ran into a store, an outdoor store, the famous Outdoor 76 off the piece at the Appalachian Trails that had sole footbeds, and just since lots have changed in terms of how hiking stuff. And then I want to put that aside, like to some of the points that you were talking about in terms of the evolution, I suppose, the progress and the journey on a personal color on the outdoors. I think from my role, my specific part in this much larger story is a little bit has a couple of different elements or dimensions, right? Like, so I was born in Sri Lanka, and I was born into a coastal small village. Like, you know, we'd still have to go to town to get to school. It's a colonial system that we had there. So we take the main road and we bike up. And my dad, later in his life, like, used to have like rice fields. So we would go to these what are quote unquote jungles, where on the other side of the jungle were guerrilla camps. And then we'd have to go to military checkpoints to get, like, I mean, 30, 40 military checkpoints in a matter of like 50 kilometers to get to this really, really remote place, even from where we lived. So that part of like going out into a space that was not habitated by everyday civilians, as opposed to like a covert place for whether it was rebels hiding in the jungle, having their bases there, where or was like rice fields in the middle of the jungle. Like, I used to go there quite a lot with my dad. So it's like all these, like, he would sometimes take me on his bicycle. Like, I know bike packing is like a big thing, and people talk about it's like, oh, it just happened. But people have been cycling long distances for work and everyday life. People have been walking. If there's one thing that classifies us as human beings, we stood up on two legs and started walking, you know, amongst other things. And we were doing that in much different context. So at the time, I would never would have considered any of those things as me as a person of color doing those things. I just liked being in those places with my dad and seeing the lush forest and being in the forest and see how different that life was. So, but in the city, like when I was still in Sri Lanka, I would, you know, like I v vividly remember once missing the school bus that my mom intentionally pays a lot of money to pick me up, because it's pretty far away, where my village home to the school was, and I would just skip the school bus just so that I could walk home. And there's at least four military or army checkpoints that you have to go through. And if you're on a bus, you have to get off the bus and go through it, and then get on back on the bus again, and then go back home. And I just like hated that, but I'm like, I'm just gonna walk through all of them. So like my journey is more or less uninterrupted. And I used to do that as a 6-year-old or 7-year-old walking by. And this one specific moment, you know, like the way the like a very distinct moment of like the world's colliding. Like, I was walking through this lush little back area above, it's in the fields in the valley by the lake, by the lagoon rather. And up above the cliff was the army camp. So I'm walking below it, so essentially bypassing that checkpoint. But just prior, after I got home, I just realized I had walked through what would now be considered one of the largest attacks on the police station. And I see that I was walking through it as that attack was unfolding, which is a pretty like stark reminder. Like, you know, much later in my life when I look back at it, like, you're just out there because you just wanted to, but then life happens around you in really, really dramatic ways, and you can never really take yourself outside from that, no matter what you think that you're doing to distance yourself from the everyday reality of things. And that's what it's like going out on the trail. It's not like, you know, it's not like you get to step through a boundary and then I'm out there in the nature. Like, that doesn't happen that way. And I think that's especially palpable for people like me who come from scenarios like me who are pretty hyper aware of that. And out here in the West, like, there's this idea that, like, if I stepped over and went up to a mountaintop, life no longer happens there. It's just the mountains. But that's a total artificial delineation of like life versus escape, and there's just no escape. Like, it might give you context, a bit of like critical distance, quite literally distance to a vantage point to look, have a micro or macrocosmic view of like what's going on around you and within you, but it's never really an escape that you get to go over, and that's become more and more refined. In New Zealand, for example, when I got to be on the awa with the Maori, like it was super telling at that point, if it wasn't already obvious to me, but at that point that, yeah, people have always been here and these places aren't wild. This is home. It has always been home to someone. The creation of wilderness as a wild space is pretty much not pretty much, it is an invention. It's a critical, discursive, ultimately colonial project. And every time we want to make that easy sort of separation, like you really have to be aware of like what you're doing. Like it's not an escape. It's having the privilege to step outside into from one paradigm to the next. And if you're and I think it would be wise to use that space to look back and have a bigger view as like where you are and why you're there, as opposed to treating it as simply as an escape all the time. And that's how it's been.
Wow, yeah. Really interesting because I imagine so many people who undertake big through hikes do so with the explicit intention of getting an escape of sorts, and in the hope of overcoming some trauma, perhaps. What I'm hearing you say is that the value in it might be to give you a shift in perspective, but it's important to realize that that shift in perspective doesn't mean that it's that you're not still very much living in the same, it's the same existence happening in a different place. It's just sort of a spatial shift.
Yeah, when you're saying that, like I just couldn't help smiling inwardly about thinking about the time Merry and Pippin try to convince the Ents to go to war against Sauron and Saruman, and they're like, and the Ents say, like we take a long time to decide whatever, they don't want to deliberating, and then Merry simply was like, aren't you part of this world? And then it wasn't until Treebeard goes and sees his kin, kith and kin, and acorns getting burned by Saruman, that like they immediately decide that this affects them. But the key thing to realize that like it doesn't matter whether you realize it or not, something what's going on around you it's affecting you. It's affecting you whether or not you realize that or not. Like you can walk through a trail through a burn section and completely ignore the environmental consequences that have led to that place being burned. And it, and but the scientific, social, ethical reality of that scenario doesn't require you to require your understanding. It is there whether you realize that or not. It is your job to figure that out in your relationship to that. And you can totally just walk through that space completely unencumbered. That doesn't mean it is not happening. And I find that quite often on trails, like when people want to push through to this idea of like trying to connect the footsteps or whatever the internal logic is. And you do need to have an internal logic for it to make sense. Absolutely. But then when that comes to shadow or overshadow, it's to a point where like you're ignoring, like people are like willing to walk through a forest fire because they want to complete that section. And that's like, that's completely ludicrous. If you can't at that point step back and say, what am I doing? What am I doing out here? And how, what is my stake in all of this? And that's and that's a degree of like your privileges, I suppose. Whether you get to ignore it or you take a step and say, okay, like there's something going on there that I'm part of that is way bigger than me. What is this? Yeah. And it's tough out there, and it's tough out there. Like the last 2 years, I think it's been very difficult for people, a lot, and everybody from health bodies to the CDC and everybody else is like actively asking people to spend a little bit more time outside in quote unquote wilder places or remoter places, not to be in contact with the COVID restrictions. And people needed that outside connection to cope with to what was going on. And I think we'll be doing that for the next several more years, and who knows how many years really the impact, the real impact of early 2020 onwards. So you see, I definitely noticed that in the last time around on the trail. The trail culture is always shifting, but the shift this time was like pretty marked. Like record numbers of people are trying to go out there and trying to push through, and then finding out that nature has other plans. Like this year on the PCT is a pretty good example. The snowpack is really high, and I keep reading articles about like I thought I had the PCT hike figured out, and then nature humbled me, or something like that. And it's great. Like if that's your first hike, and that's kind of what happens. Like you figure it out. But if you've done this often enough, at this point, I think those of us who have done a few more hikes to really, really stand up and to start realizing, like, okay, what does this mean to walk outside, and what is my role in here? Like, that is it just about me having a completely self-involved experience, or do you have now a responsibility, an even more acute sense of responsibility, because you have done it a couple of times, to be responsible for your footsteps. And where you take those footsteps and how you take them.
Which leads me to the obvious question of what is it that you see as your responsibility when you take those footsteps and how you take them?
It's never one thing, and always. I try to be mindful as much as I can that, especially now, like just how much of a financial, mental, gender, able, like the fact that I'm able, like all of these attributes allows me to do these things in a way that like other people can't. And I'm certainly like I know the sacrifices that I've had to make this happen for over the last decade. But now, like on the PCT, like when the fires were happening, I was just really fortunate. I would be fortunate when I saw pools of water where I wouldn't see one. I was grateful to find patches of snow on dry deserts. I was grateful to find actually a little anecdote. Somebody one day asked me like, what is it that I'm most grateful for on the trail? And I couldn't, without thinking, I said like, it's that little bit of breeze that you get on a really hot day. I'm grateful to be there and know the ways in which I'm privileged to be there, and in like very close proximity to like in the ways in which how many so many people can't, and they would, even if it's just for the quote unquote escape reasons, they just would rather be there than where they are right now. Like I'm always aware of that, and of course, like I'm always aware of like on whose historical footsteps I'm walking on, and who's going to come after me. I'm always thinking about that.
Do you find that you carry a greater sense of responsibility or as walking as a person of color on these trails in such a stark minority? Do you find that that comes with an added sense of responsibility for yourself in any way, not in terms of, well, yeah, in any way, in terms of interactions with other people on a day-to-day basis, or in terms of representing a culture, or in terms of does it come with an added sense of responsibility in any way for you?
I sometimes if I do feel like I don't have a choice in the matter. So it was definitely true in the in, earlier when I was when there was a lot less people of color on the trail, at least that I could notice that the landscape, quite literally, the demographic has changed. It is cool to see more and more very, very different people from very, very different backgrounds and abilities and aptitudes being on trail these days. It's really neat to see. So the conversations that I was starting to get embroiled in the 10 years ago on the AT is very different from what I would have for now on the PCT or like the CDT on the Arizona Trail, for example. I think again the politics also, like when I say politics, I mean literal election politics, for example, in the US and Canada has shifted a lot of those conversations to sometimes in really, really shrill tones as well. Like, I don't know what my hiking experience would have been like, in the early 2000s if I were, that was the first time I started out hiking. I can say that, in terms of what you're talking about, responsibilities, like, once Acuna Will Robinson, he's a veteran, he's one of the first, African Americans to, Triple Crown. It was in 2019. When he did that, when he did his Triple Crown on the CDT and the AT and the PCT, him and I were talking about once, and he told me sometimes as a black man on that trail, like you mentioned, that like sometimes you really have to watch what you're gonna say to someone who's being fill in the blank, because it's not just a matter of how that person is gonna react to you, but how that person is going to treat somebody coming behind him because of the encounter that he had with this person. So as much as you might have the urge to like stand up and be confrontational, be friendly, be whatever, and you also have to might be mindful that like, how is this interaction going to impact someone's coming behind me? And that's a calculus. That's a lot of things to worry about. Like, thru hiking is hard enough and you just want to go for a walk for 2,000 miles. But when you have to start thinking about like the impact that like your words, your action, your very specific act words and actions, how that might have ramifications for people who have gone or come behind you strictly because of how somebody else perceives you, that's a thing, you know? That's a thing that
For sure.
if you don't ever have to experience that, and you don't know what that
You
weight
don't
is like. You
know
just
what
won't
it's
know.
like.
But if you do, then you just you don't ever not to get to unshed that weight either. You always have to. Is this the moment that I'm going to stand up for myself? Is this the moment that I'm going to have to literally watch and say, if I picked a fight here or if I did this way, like, is this person then going to do something else to somebody else coming behind me? And it's a and it's a Your health and safety is at stake at that point, not just your mental health, but like your somebody else's. Like you're now directly responsible for somebody else with no control over what happens on the other side, and it's
Yeah,
perennial.
sure. I mean, it's awesome to hear that the landscape is changing, that the demographic is changing. That's really encouraging. One of the things in the wake of George Floyd's death, you wrote an awesome blog article for us, titled "Diversity is not a hashtag." And I remember one of the points that you made was, and it's almost this the same point that you've been making, framed in a different way in terms of not being able to step away from these things. Like, you can try and escape these things, but they are real and they're happening whether you want to acknowledge them or not. But you made a point of people saying like, I don't want to talk about politics or not even talk about politics necessarily, not even but I came out here to be to have sort of an apolitical experience to escape the burdens of this type of stuff that we all deal with, and especially in the States over the last, 7 years, I guess. And the point that you made, which was, well, I mean, that's easy for you to say, but my life and existence is inherently has become inherently politicized. I'm not sure. I don't want to put words in your mouth. I'm not sure if that was exactly how you expressed it. But that point really struck home to me, and I think the example that you've just made is a really good example of that, of exactly that idea. It would be easy for someone to perceive you as having a mission as sort of an advocate for people of color on the trail, or is that how you see yourself? Or do you just see yourself as a guy who goes out to hike, who has to deal with the difficulties of the realities of racial dynamics?
I don't necessarily see, it's certainly not how I set out to be. In fact, it wasn't until almost halfway through the AT, Pine Grove Furnace, when I, Pine Grove Furnace, by the way, it's in Pennsylvania, just, it's reputed to be a station on the Underground Railroad, unofficial station on the Underground Railroad. And up until then, I've met any, maybe two or three thru hikers of color. One of them, maybe two of them, were actually black. Wasn't exactly sure if they're African American or not, but two black hikers. And I was sitting in there. It was a very dark night. June bugs or lightning bugs are all around. It was pretty amazing, incredible. And I was in this amazing old historical place, and I had just walked through Civil War monuments, and I just couldn't shake this feeling of just walking after like Antietam Hall, which is like a massive, massive Civil War battleground, and you couldn't, like, I'm a history buff, so I just couldn't shake the feeling. Like I kept imagining like the scene, the Civil War scene, are all around me, like watching this beautifully, beautiful park, which was probably would have been just covered in like human gore at one point in time. And I was walking through it, and it was surreal to juxtapose my, what I would say at the time, like literally like being on a 1,000 mile fried chicken and beer pub crawl that I was having from Georgia all the way at this point. And then to have this, like, the past, it's so concurrent. It was so there, and you walk through that heaviness, and whether it's perceived or real or whatever, it doesn't matter. But people died in that spot badly, and people died in that spot badly fighting for something that they believed in, whatever that might have been. And you're walking through that space, and then you sit in this one spot where supposed to be where somebody was trying to get to their freedom. Literally, I'm walking through this quote unquote unencumbered, and here was this particular person who would have sat in that trapdoor cellar underneath, who didn't have that feeling whatsoever. And I lowered myself into that little trap hole, and it was completely dark, and just a little, it wasn't freedom that I felt there. Like it was just terror. It was just sitting there in that darkness, surrounded by the silence and June bugs. It was terror. I could not appreciate the beauty of a summer night with oak trees full of lightning bugs. I couldn't. I was just sad and angry. And it was so pervasive. And I have really good memories of June bugs growing up in Sri Lanka, because this was a time that I was lying in the fields with my dad, and they would come up. And then all of a sudden, I realized. And this was a point later told to me by somebody else who'd gone through the Syrian Civil War related to June bugs, was that like we'd only see June bugs when there was no fighting. Like they wouldn't come out if the bullets were being fired. And this kid was like going through a kayaking trip, the Syrian refugee kid that another group that I work with called the Refugee Adventure and Education Challenges, in our organization working with the refugee children, taking them outside and STEM spelled education now. And he was relating the story about how excited that he was to see June bugs or lightning bugs in the wild, because the last time that he had seen them is before the bomb started dropping. And I distinctly remember having that reaction to lighting bugs in that cellar 10 years ago. And then sitting now after having heard that story and remembering like all my war trauma and going through that battlefield, and just like, and that was the year that the Warrior Hike started on the Appalachian Trail. Warrior Hike is a program out there for, to send veterans with PTSD. They send them out with gear to hike so they can walk off the war, which is essentially sort of the if you were to find the beginning for the Appalachian Trail. Earl Schaefer just walked the trail. He was trying to walk off the war. So, like, even the modern history of the Appalachian Trail proper as a through hike begins at a moment before it was a trail. Like, it begins in the middle of a traumatic experience. It comes into being as a trail, as a concept, as a metaphor, as a process, as a journey, because of the history, personal and a larger history that goes into shaping it as such. And here you are, right in the middle of it. And you can have your 2,000-mile chicken wings and beer every trail town. I did that and it was great. And I was grateful for it. But it's also this other history. It's also a history of war and trauma and the ability for someone to be quote unquote free. In a very real sense, especially in the US, especially on the AT. And I didn't get to really sit and grapple with that literally until I, 1,000 miles later, it hit me like the force of, lack of a very obvious pun, like it's the weight of trauma sitting in that hole. And it was sudden, and I haven't been able to shake it since. I would like to think that I walked to make space and hold space for all the traumatic things that I've witnessed and experienced since as a little kid, from war and dislocation and everywhere. But just because I go on a trail doesn't mean those things go away. Like, they become more and more palpable at you, and the more you start paying attention to them, like, and realize just how much is untold. And how many of what we see on Instagram and media, like, and even those people who say that they're doing, that's the scaffold of what happens on a trail. What's going on inside for those people, it's completely different, and won't always make the trending videos on Instagram or social media. But it's a challenging space. And as you said earlier, you don't get to walk away from who you are. It'll catch up to you at some point.
Sure. And you don't, yeah, I guess that's, you don't get to walk away from where you are either, I guess, as part of the point. Wherever you are, there will always be things, that, well, reminders, as you say, of things gone before that might trigger specific memories or specific feelings, specific ways of relating to the suffering of other people. Yeah, really interesting. I can't stop thinking about, I assume that June bugs are what we in South Africa would have called fireflies.
There.
And I also have a similar, I remember being in the Kruger National Park in South Africa, in a riverbed, on the very opposite end of the experience of fireflies from yours, but being in a game drive vehicle in the Kruger National Park, where the only way you can really experience the area is from the back of a vehicle. Well, you can go on guided hikes, but you're absolutely not allowed to just hike through the reserve on your own because it's just too dangerous. But this, it's also a childhood memory that will always be with me, is this particular moment of driving into this river valley and the driver switching off the car and the lights and everything and just sitting in silence. And after a few moments of the sound of the engine fading away, all of these flashing lights just filling the whole of the river valley. And yeah, something spectacular about that sort of imagery for me as well.
I think the June bugs, it's a bit incidental to this conversation that we're having, but
For sure,
June
yeah.
bugs, I think it's a pretty neat one. Like I look at fog the same way on trail. Like I think fog for me, like it erases all contours. Like if there's ever a time that you think that you're time traveling, it's walking through somewhere. It doesn't matter where. It doesn't even have to be the mountains. It can be downtown Vancouver. Walk through it in the fog. And you can't, I think you'd have to be pretty distracted to not feel that you have stepped through some sort of time portal that it dissolves all contours. It's sort of like it dissolves that time and space in a little way. And I feel that on the trail that I love being when there's fog around. And same way in the lightning bugs. This is a creature literally just emitting electricity out there in the still of the night, and there's something very ethereal about it. And it's got a way of like start tugging at these discordant threads that are constantly running in you. It's like you can, I suppose, you can choose to step away something, but you're always walking with that, whatever it is that you try to step away from. There's no.
And perhaps that is what is so special about something like an extended through hike. I mean, you're spending 3 months on trail,
Yeah, 3 to 4 months depends on
three to
trail.
four months. Is that in all that time you are, when you said fog, I thought smoke as well, almost the opposite end of the same thing, but instead of being sort of it has the same sort of contour erasing effect, but in like a red and hot way rather than in like a white and cool way.
It's almost like a warning, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
It's like a repellent intimation. It
And
literally does.
so, yeah. And so I'm thinking like, spending, that amount of time surrounded by things which can't help but make you experience your life in a sort of very real and present way, right? Because it's not, you're never going to get that same, well, maybe not never, but it's you don't have the distractions of life that can prevent you from living memories and experiences and having sort of physical and emotional reactions to the world around you, and those things are real. It's why we have it's why things are spooky if there it's why we use fog machines in ghost stories, is that specific physical stimuli produce specific emotional reactions and results within us. And so perhaps being outside, surrounded by these types of things all day, all night for 4 months helps us to move through the things that we need to move through. Maybe that's the, I remember, and I mean, I kind of started off by saying, by mentioning trauma, and I guess trauma is kind of a common thread through the conversation and through the, I'm sure, the stories of a lot of people. I had one of my best friends passed away a couple of years ago from cancer during COVID, actually. And he was back in South Africa. And I couldn't go home and say goodbye to him, and after he died, I went and hiked the Wandafuka Trail on out there on the island. And there was something about looking up at the trees blowing in the wind. You know, I had been hearing the needles rustling in the swaying trees above me, and there was this one particular moment in which I looked up and just saw the sort of dizzying tops of trees swaying around in the wind. And there was something about that moment, I think, that I don't know what it was in particular, but triggered sort of an emotional release in myself, that I really needed, you know, dealing with all the stuff that I was dealing with. Anyway, I don't know if that's why, to some extent, we love being out there as much as we do, everybody, whether we know it or not, or whether we can acknowledge it or not. But yeah.
Yeah, that's really beautiful, Paul. I'm glad that you're able to connect with yourself that way. And at the end of the day, that's what it is. Like you become hyper aware of like what's going on for you, and like your surroundings provide context for that. Now, when you were talking about it, like I'm this like the fog and some of these things that I think about quite a lot of them. It's like, why is it that staring into a fire or a sunset produces a feeling and a sort of this ephemeral feeling of expansiveness within yourself or whatever, or closeness. Like we can say for certain, with like 100% certainty, I suppose, like under there, that a human being on this planet about 80,000 years ago wasn't looking at another human being through a computer screen, but they were watching a fire. If there's one connective thread that we have to the very first life forms on this planet up until the present day, it's not necessarily with the things that we have, but like these things that seem to endure, that has the way of like bringing us back to this primordial timelessness of all things. Some things have always been here. Some things will always be here. And no matter how many modern trappings that we have, like we move through that space, and those things move through with us, alongside us. And every now and then you get a reminder of the timelessness of it all, and like how much of what we have, the trappings, the 24-hour clock, our work schedules, the Instagram message, whatever that might be, like how much of that is it's there's this impermanence of all things, and in a strange way, like the fleetingness of it, like this is the fleeting bit, but there are some other things that have just been here, and you get to connect and be part of it, and then and for a brief moment, like you feel yourself understood to yourself.
For sure. And there is something about that particular being able to sit and, you know, we were talking earlier about perspective and the role of, you know, you gain this perspective by actually putting in all the steps. You know, maybe it's a moment of being alone on a trail in a forest surrounded by ancient trees, or the only person as far as you can see on a desert scape, and getting that real sense of like being small in the world, you know, and your own impermanence. But yeah, I like that mentioned specifically of fire, and that universal thing of sitting and watching fire, and that, as you say, sort of primordial, there's something about it that just feels kind of right to everybody. There's something about sitting looking into a fire that feels comforting in its in its enduring nature, I guess, and or its constance, even though it itself is a fleeting thing, right? The fire, each flame is a reaction of energy which is there for only an instance, and then it's gone. but the enduring nature of fire itself is something that everybody can commonly, something that I think of quite often, and maybe it's just me, but I love looking at a river or a waterfall, and you always think of like you see a river as a constant. It's a flowing solid, I mean it's not solid, it's liquid obviously, but it's you think of it as one unit, like a homogeneous thing. But something that always I love to think about looking at a river is that each part of that river is only there in that one instance as it's flowing past, and it starts somewhere else and it goes somewhere else. And even though the river is this constant flow, that is always give or take, always there, each part of that river is gone in an instance. It's over there and then it's there and then it's gone. It's the sort of the fleeting and permanent nature of things that can happen sort of simultaneously.
I suppose like you call it the paradox of connecting to the eternal through the transient. But there's a Canadian scholar, Indigenous scholar, and writer. Her name is Leanne Bettis-Masake Simpson. She wrote this beautiful book, an argument essentially called As We Have Always Done, which is a running common enough trend if you try to identify a running trend in any Indigenous politics these days. It's always come down to as we have always done. We're not trying to restart something. It's a continuity. It's a continuity. And that's what we all trying to do, like live and be here on this planet and try to keep it a continuity. That's a very different broad topic on its own.
But totally relevant. Thinking about the thing that jumps to mind immediately is sort of fire management policies, like we should learn from indigenous people and cultures.
One of the key things that I've time and again that I've come across with my statedly fairly limited interactions, but fairly involved within that limited interaction with the Indigenous communities, particularly in New Zealand and some in the West Coast here, is there is a strong sense of reciprocity that goes into your day-to-day life. There's never a sense of like you can't take this idea of like let's take like national parks for example, as the creation of the national parks. So national parks, especially in North America, comes to be quote unquote created. It designates first of all the wilderness space. It declares at its genesis, declares what has been home where people had lived, hunted, lived, and had a reciprocal relationship with stewarding the land, and in turn, the land stewarding themselves, having establishing that equilibrium for thousands and thousands of years. And all of a sudden, we get this set of laws and an infrastructure that designates what was home as wilderness, as if this is a place where no one has been, but for specific reasons, right? Like for specific reasons, and predominantly to have a hunting and fishing club for, and this is a quote like from some of the texts that I've read, like hunting and fishing club for like the quote Anglo American sportsman types. So idea of preserving the landscape so that people can go hunt and fish. This was the founding principle behind finding a national park. Preservation, and you always have to ask, what is it being preserved and conserved for? Versus like the idea of like reciprocity, like the newest established national park in Canada, the Tidenini National Park up in just northern Canada here, like near Slave Lake. Like there, as you know, you can't take anything from a national park. You can't harvest lumber. You can't shoot animals. It's easy and an historical anachronism to think of it as a conservation measure for the betterment of the environment. Like it's pretty easy to fall into that trap, but that's never been the intention. The intention so that like indigenous people weren't taking that Indigenous people weren't taking the fur and shooting the animals and hunting the animals or taking the land. It's to prevent them so that you can have this very specific type of people can go do just that. Taitanini Park, on the other hand, allows for reciprocal harvesting or reciprocal stewardship of the land, where like the point is never that you're never going to take from the land, but it's just that you're going to take from the land in such a way that it fosters mutual continuity, not to a point that you're not that you can't you just put a full stop to it and you can't do anything whatsoever. It's just that you don't take it to a point where it threatens your own existence. That's the model that we have outside of that. But when I say something or Indigenous people, particularly when the ancestors text talks about as they've always done, that's basically it's a type of reciprocal sovereignty within yourself and within the environment that you live in, such that you live in a sovereign state where sovereignty doesn't mean our liberal ideas of freedoms of movement or speech or any of that. It is that your own existence isn't threatened by the way in which you live. You maintain a continuity at all times so that you continue to live. You continue to exist on this planet in harmony, in reciprocal harmony, in reciprocal give and take that doesn't compromise neither you nor where are you taking it from. And she does this with this brilliant story about the beavers. And she did actually the Ideas podcast on the beavers and the brilliance of beavers, it's called. And she talks about this ethics of reciprocity that indigenous cultures, particularly North America, but like pretty much I would argue throughout the world, have maintained for so long prior to colonization or colonial impact.
It strikes me that those ideas of as we have always done and sort of as it has always been, you know, are it's two sides of the same coin, perhaps. You know, we exist as we always have done, in this place, which is as it has always been, you know, a home, the planet, the place where we all live. So we should continue as we have always done in order to live in this place as it has always been, because it sustains us. You know, we can live in this way as we always have, because the place can sustain us as long as we continue to live in this way. And we don't, you know, as long as it is as it has always been, we can live as we always have done.
The Maori people in New Zealand, like they were simply there, like land and people as one. That it's not that people, the land is the context for people, that there's just no people without the land, period. The land is and the people is the land, and that's there's no separation there. Land as people as one. Would be like one term, but there are multiple ways in which that's articulated, and like the Maori way of looking at things. But yeah, it's yeah the it's yeah the reciprocity, I think it's misunderstood, like what that means, like responsible ethical reciprocity. There is a give and a take. There's always a calculus involved, and the calculus is one of continuity and existence as opposed to sheer extraction.
So I wonder if there's a model for, I wonder if we could, yeah. I mean, I'm just thinking about how when you go on a long through hike, you do so very much in the way of, you know, you're interacting with the land around you, but in very much not in as people have always done, you know. You've got a whole lot of high-tech ultralight gear you might have, and maybe you've got freeze-dried meals, maybe you're just on ramen noodles. But how much of, you know, there's this ability to connect with the place. And I guess that's also what a lot of people are looking for is, you know, it may be to deal with, it may be both running, like escaping from the world that they inhabit on a day-to-day basis, and the sort of general burdens of a modern life, you could describe it, but it's equally running to trying to reestablish a connection with being outside, with the natural world, which so many people have lost to such a great extent. And yet there's so much of the through hike experience, which is kind of, and I guess maybe it should be, the merits of it should be assessed, or it should be assessed on its own merits rather than trying to compare it to something like living in true reciprocity with the land. I guess this is all a garbled way of saying, is there anything about the through hiking experience that could be changed or that could be adjusted in order to help people come to a more of a, or maybe it isn't through hiking, maybe there should be some other type of experience to help people come to more of a fundamental understanding of their connection to the land, and that's to help break down that separation between people and the planet.
I think it happens. I think it happens on hikes, whether you're fully cognizant of it or not. Like you can't not help it. Like I've never been a super speed hiker. Like I hike fast, but I'm not out there to set fastest known time hikes or. I'm only bringing that up to suggest that like I don't know what that experience is like, but I can, if I were to hazard a guess. I would imagine there is an element of, what we call flow state in it that's pervasive in any time that we're able to, what is flow state, right? It's such a fluid term, but we all know roughly that it is one of those moments, sometimes prolonged, sometimes fleeting, always impermanent. Feeling that you get when you get the sense that your body, that your mind, your total being, your total epistemological, physiological being is in tune with something. It's just not even with something, that it's just in tune, that is tuned to and tuned with, and it's just simply in tune. And that's the best way I can explain flow. And that flow state experience happens to everyone on a through hike. I think it happens to pretty much everybody on life. Like, like if I were to get really like theoretical about it, like there's an interesting book William James has written, it's called The Varieties of Religious Experience. In it, like he's tried to describe what he calls a what do you call it? Like utter complete euphoria. Where people have this like out of body experience, and he has like three characteristics that's like these are the ways in which that happens, and one of them is that like which always stuck with me is that it's both ineffable and has a noetic quality. So basically, like so he's saying like a mystical experience, that's what he calls it, because he's looking at it like a religious perspective, and he's saying that it's got a noetic quality and it is ineffable. Meaning it can never be put into words in a way that it makes some sense to somebody else, but it has absolute sense of truth to it as it's happening to you. And that's all there is to it. On the one hand, it sets itself up to be like, well, if that's the case, then like any experience, it's just completely subjective, probably. But anyone who have experienced it know that at some point that did that happen. They might not even be able to identify it. But they know in the course of the activity that event that it happened, and it happens on through hikes. And I think that's the beauty of it. Like, and the more and more you're cognizant, more and more you force yourself to be aware of your footsteps to the landscape, or to your heartbeat, to your thoughts. Like, be aware of like all the thoughts, the intrusive ones, the good ones, the bad ones. It's all you. It's like it's all coming from you. No one's putting those thoughts in your head. It's all you. Like your mental being is your physical being, and it's happening at all times. And the more you're trying to be aware of that in the activity that you're doing, in the pursuit of whatever it is, that it's work, through hiking or whatever. In through hike, it's a little bit more obvious because you've created this, as you say, like an artificial parameter around which something that we're all trying to do. And it becomes the opportunity for that happening is more because you've now, mentally or literally just stripped away some of the distractions. But it happens to us all the time. And I think on through hikes, the more you force yourself to be aware, the more yourself force yourself to quote unquote meditate, or just to be in to be present, to all the to all the words that we use in our daily life that people tell us to do now for our mental health. Like the more you try to do all those things, that you realize that like, yeah, like you are at every point, like you're hoping, you're learning, you're wanting to connect to yourself. And if connecting, Richard Wagamese wrote this book called Starlight, and in it, like, he talks about the journey of this young man going through watching animals as taking nature photography. And he talks about it this way, like watching the wolf in the quiet of the night, crouched with a camera, watching it through that very intentional act of looking at this other life form through this contraption in this artificial scenario, brings to him to understand himself better in observing something outside of him. And that process, I don't think you can put that into words, but we all know what that's like.
You've just I've always, I told just a little anecdote about being in the Kruger National Park as a child, and you've just explained to me, in a way, why being in the Kruger National, I would always sort of joke that, oh, the closest thing my family has to church, right? Our version of spiritual experiences was going to the Kruger National Park once a year and having that exact experience of sitting quietly in a car, watching wild animals through binoculars, and that exact sort of sense of being present, in that moment and in that exercise and pursuing that exercise just for the sake of it as well. So there you go. You've helped me understand. You've unlocked a little a little explanation to why those were such sort of quasi-spiritual, or not quasi-spiritual, experiences for us, I guess. One thing that that interests me about this, about all this, is the dynamic between being alone and having that time, and putting that effort into, sort of intentionally, giving space to your awareness of your physical experience, and your surroundings, and the dynamic of the social element of through hikes, which seems to be such an important thing for so many people. And I guess when you're hiking for 4 months, you have time to chat to people and take the time on your own. I wonder, yeah, if you had anything to say on that in terms of those dynamics in particular, or what. Where you, if you see a particular value personally, to either side of that perhaps false dichotomy.
I suppose like I'm a bit of an introvert in some a lot of ways. I mean, trail communities, it's a really, it can be a great source of linear family. And I'm grateful for a lot of the connections that have come specifically because I started hiking. It's unlikely that I don't know, but like I feel like it would be unlikely that we'd be having this conversation if I didn't decide that I wasn't going to get out of grad school and go for a walk on the AT. Accidentally walking into that store in North Carolina that sold Sole footbeds, which pretty much changed the way I hike. And I haven't hiked a single mile without them since, like 200 miles in, and I've got a pair of soles, and almost 8,000 miles later, I'm still here with them. And that's a really fascinating thread. Like, And we can only make sense of those kind of stories by looking backwards, right? Like every, you can throw a connected thread if you're willing to look back to anything, really. But the exciting bit, the value is that like you don't know how your interaction with a specific moment in place and space and with another person will have consequences or ramifications for yourself and that person. And thrugging is really beautiful that way because it exposes you to such a large array of people. I certainly would have never met, not in terms of distances, but the types of people that I've met and the types of connections that I was able to have without having that as a as an avenue to meet them. And there are tons of ways in which that happens, you know, in the professional world, you call it networking. But when you're out hiking, when you have a shared experience that is that has moments of pain, and I think Peggy Phelan is a theorist, and she talks about like a ontology of performance, meaning it's a really complicated term, but essentially what she's talking about is that like how do we exist in this world? And she says that like if we at all understand ourselves, it's never in isolation, but always as what she would call in a in an intersubjective moment. Meaning you can only understand yourself through interaction with something outside of yourself, another self, even if that self just happens to be yourself, and a version or iteration, as you would call it, of yourself. As and then for her, like one of the things that resists this sort of the transience of existence is pain. Like for her, literally pain. Like she's like, pain is not transient. Like you know, like the physical pain, it leaves a trace. Like you know it. And in a thru hiking, war, anything that can be that has that potential for injury and harm binds you to places in a very special way, I think. Because on the one hand, you have this fleeting experience that's being forged. On the other hand, you have this very real thing that you know that just happened to you, that you know that's probably going to happen to somebody else. Dr. Morgan would have talked about it, like foot pain is a thing, like blisters are a thing. These are things that I don't have to like explain to you as to what's happening. That m memory of that pain, however individual a pain, personal it might be, it's a point of convergence for you, and a breakdown of this like hyper individualism that we have ourselves. Like you get to really feel that you're having a shared communal experience that is both you and not you and everybody around you. And thru hiking is special that way, and it's like it's innate. I suppose war is the same way. It's for anything that involves, and as Peggy Phelan say, anything that leaves you with the trace, that the inestimable, inestimable. I can't pronounce that word. It's such a hard something that cannot be assimilated into just only yourself, just yourself. That you have to recognize that not only yourself, but yourself in relation to somebody else. And that happens so often on the trail. And it's a beautiful, beautiful thing to see yourself reflected in other people's eyes, see yourself reflected in other people's stories, and they see themselves reflected in your story. And you get to have that shared story grounded by this thing that is like the closest thing that comes to being something that is very permanent, which is literally the painful aspects of hiking. Like hiking is not glamorous. Like it's a lot of days are painful, a lot of the days are hurt. But then you don't get to be better at it. You just learn to make that part of the much larger story for yourself and the community. And for sure, it's as much as like the very superficial implications of bubbles, and bubbles are a large collection of hikers who congregate at one given spot. There's value. There's definitely value in having shared moments with other people. Helps you understand yourself better.
For sure. Awesome. Well, yeah, I think we kind of need to wrap this up.
Sure.
As much as I'm enjoying myself. Thanks very much, Amethan. I don't know if there's anything else that you would like to speak to in particular or mention.
Oh, no, thank you for, like responding to that email a long time ago. It was not much of a person to reach out like that. And my partner, she asked me, maybe you should, because you liked it so much. And so thanks for always, like, for supporting me in that process, but also literally, like, foot pain is a real thing, and like, it's real, and there's so many, and Dr. Morgan would have said this, and like any other hiker, like, it's a, you don't have to suffer needlessly out there. The suffering is inevitable, but you don't have to suffer needlessly. So thanks for literally supporting me on that front all these years.
Awesome. Yeah, I love that. You will suffer, but you don't have to. You can cut down the suffering. There are ways to minimize your suffering for sure. Yeah, no, well, geez, we're totally happy to support you, and yeah, love seeing all that you do, and I've really enjoyed this conversation. Yeah, and we look forward to what do you have coming up? Do you have anything in particular that you're doing this year? I know you spent some time tree planting.
I
Oh, that
did.
was the year
I
before last, eh?
yeah, that was doing it. I had to try it just to see. I will be so happy knowing that I put 70,000 trees in the ground. That's it's one of my I did that, done that. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that is amazing. Wow.
Yeah, I have a really cool opportunity coming up with Sawyer, who also do some great work. Did a lot of, so we'll be going down to a tiny South or Pacific island in Oceania, to set up some water filters for this community, way out in
Wow.
the middle of the ocean. So I'm super
Wow.
stoked to go help out
Amazing.
with that project, and hopefully, if things line up, I don't want to even have to say it out loud because it never happens sometimes, but maybe hike the Hayduke Trail later this year.
Awesome. Wow. Fantastic. Well, yeah, I'm happy to give a little shout out to Sawyer. I mean, that sounds like a great trip, but my favorite piece of gear, other than my Sol footbeds, of course, is my Sawyer mini filter as well, which I first came across thanks to you and Zelzen Akitali, who's also a Sawyer ambassador. So yeah, shout out to Sawyer. That sounds like an awesome trip. Great. Well, thank you very much.
All
And good luck on those endeavors. And yeah, have
right.
an awesome day.
Talk soon.
Cheers, Empa.
Cheers. Good luck. Bye-bye.